I've got your outline as to what you'd like to talk about here today. Trying to rather hurriedly and in a concise way skip through that outline that you provided me as far as the skeleton and following. What am I doing? Since 1964, I've been learning about a million Indians in America. You can see them scattered all over in the pink spots. Those are the federal reservations in the United States, and then east of the Mississippi, there are a lot more reservations which aren't on the map because they're state reservations. I've been learning about a million Indians in America, about Indians in the city, about Indians in the country, about Indians in between, like here. About troubles with Indian education. You see the material that this child is studying from, kind of white, middle class oriented material, the pitch in Indian education, both with respect to schools and government, for years and years has been on the basis of an ignoring of what the child knows and understands from his own life and culture, and a kind of a spoon feeding and kind of a reshaping of the child according to middle-class white American standards and values. I'm learning about the problem with Indian health, about the problem, the need of Indian housing, about Indian unemployment, about Indian drunkenness and suicide and death, about Indian family breakdown, hopelessness and despair, about Indian prejudice and discrimination as it is directed against the Indians by the whites in the land, about Indian survival and Indian hope, something that most of the historians and the anthropologists are just unable to explain, how this race of people has been able to survive under the rigors of what it has suffered. About Indian history, about Indian culture and hope and values, and learning about some of these things. About Indian humor and fun, Indian values, Indian likes and dislikes, Indian achievement, Indian kinship, something entirely different from what we experience in our lives with our little close-knit nuclear families where only those within our immediate reach, father, mother, daughter, son, is of importance and of concern to us, really. Whereas the Indian people looked upon, in most instances, looked upon second and third cousins, grandmothers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers and uncles and aunts and great-aunts as though they were immediate members of their own immediate family. And they have this kind of feeling and responsibility toward them that you would have toward your wife or your father or your mother. This is something about which we need to understand. About Indian spirituality, about Indian promise, about Indian organization, Indian power. I've been trying to help others learn also with respect to what I've been doing since 1964 when I was called to this position. I've been helping congregations committees and groups within the topical district of the Lutheran Church to learn about some of these things that we never looked into before. The Lutheran Church and Missouri Synod, particularly the Mission Board, other districts, congregations, organizations, individuals, other synods, American Lutheran Church, Lutheran Church of America, none of which has anyone in a position such as mine, and yet they have people who are interested in Indian ministry who are looking for help and guidance and enablement to fulfill a responsibility that they acknowledge. And trying to help a little bit to the Lutheran Council in the USA, sensitizing them to some of the things about the Indian people in America that they need to know if they're going to effectively carry on and fulfill any kind of far-reaching ministry. And trying to contribute to the kind of concern that will issue in real communication and real Christian response on the part of our church to Indian open opportunities for ministry. You had one part of your outline was concerned with the uniqueness of this ministry. I think it's unique in so many respects that it's hard to respond. It's a whole new world, a different world, a kind of a foreign mission within the boundaries of the United States of America. I've got on the tape a little bit if there's some of you who want to stay over or here after the presentation here. Some, for instance, Indian music, if you've never heard any, and a few other things that I have on the airline, welcome too. I think it kind of communicates some of the uniqueness in a way that words don't avail too much. I think we need to understand, too, actually, who are the foreigners, you know? Maybe a foreign mission to us, but as far as Indians are concerned, we're the foreigners. And I've been in situations frequently with Indian groups where, you know, I'm in the minority and I'm introduced as the visiting American, because I'm here among the originals, you know. And usually we have the opposite point of view. We talk about how the West was won, they talk about how the West was lost. And it's important that you realize this difference of perspective. These are the people who were here to greet Columbus when he landed, you know? And yet every textbook in almost every elementary school in the United States begins with Columbus discovered America. You know, and our kids are brainwashed into actually ignoring and being indifferent to and viewing Indian people as somehow less than human. Things that don't really have to be considered when history is written. It's a unique ministry with respect to this different world, actually, that the Indian people occupy for the most part. It's a group of people whom the United States government has treated uniquely, as no other group of people in America from the inception of this government. Indian people have been treated, and not as a mass either, have been treated as separate sovereign nations within a nation. Imagine, we've dealt with this people for generations. Decades through the War Department that we would deal with foreign nations and have treaties and alliances, this type of thing. Then the Indian people were relegated to the Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. We don't have a Bureau of Irish Affairs, you know, or a Bureau of German Studies. But we've had, for over 100 years now, a Bureau of Indian Affairs, which is, has ascended to the type of bureaucracy that is almost incredible to behold. There are 15, for every 15 Indians in the United States, there's one federal government employee within the structure of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Pretty good transformation about this time. And yet, we haven't gotten very far with this thing. The Indians are crying out now, you know. Why are we under the governance of the Department of the Interior, you know? The Department of the Interior, what does that have to do with it? Trees and rivers and rocks, you know, and geology and land and Indian people. And the whole education system of the Indian people is not with health, education, and welfare, or with the education department of this country, but it's with the Department of the Interior, who are specialists in trees and rocks and minerals, not with people. Special rights. It's unique because this people are the only people in the United States, to my knowledge, that has special rights that go far beyond the civil rights that everyone's crying about. Indians have special treaty rights, which relate to specific acts of Congress, which the United States government has guaranteed to these Indians under signatures of George Washington, famous president, and more than 260 treaties with the various Indian tribes in the United States. Not one of them has ever been kept. Not one promise that the government has made to the Indian people has ever been kept with respect to the American government. And so they're really up in arms about their treaty claims and their treaty rights, their special rights as citizens of the United States. And the Indian people in the United States.
Unique with respect to
conflicting culture and colliding values.
It's just incredible
how the culture
that you and I were raised in with, and to which we owe so much of our behavior,
is so diametrically
opposed
to what the Indian people
stand for
and how they are brought up to live. A few simple examples. For example, the competitive of the culture that you and I are used to, the
competitiveness
as opposed to the cooperation. And
this thing conflicts right away. You see it in the classroom. Whereas we have taught the Indian children as though they were white children. We have taught them to compete with one another. And this is causing a tremendous conflict in their lives because they've been taught not to compete with one another.
We give them
a gold star for achievement, and for outshining someone else. And we can't understand why this white boy in this Indian class gets a gold star and then he
hands in zeros until the rest of the class has gotten gold stars.
Then he
goes out again. And
honor roll and this type of thing, you know. We expect them to compete the way we are taught and have learned to compete. And we expect them to take a great pride and satisfaction and don't be honored if you eat upon them and instead of helping them or hurting them because they become outcast in their own group as they conform to our expectations of them. Another conflict and collision of values, the accumulation factor in our culture where the person is respected and loved and honored and emulated and applauded who accumulates the most for himself and his family, you know? Who makes the most money, who has the biggest car and so forth, who accumulates the most. Whereas in the older Indian culture and some of the remnants of this carried on, the person who is honored, loved, and respected is the person who gives away everything he has. And instead of giving the bride and the groom who are getting married, and instead of people coming and showering gifts upon them, you know, and giving them a good bag to start out with, in the Indian way, by the father of the bride and the groom, they give everything away to the guests. They give the horses, they give the cattle, they give the pots and the pans and the house, and after the wedding, they have nothing. They are a kid comes back from Vietnam, they do this. And then the rest of the community then pitches in and picks them up and helps you doing that. Directly opposed to what we expect and what we experience. And you can see the implications this has for Christian work, you know, because the Christianity in our culture, we've had to kind of rationalize away some of those nice passages in Scripture that talk about giving the church and all, your brother, and giving away everything that you have to your neighbor. We've kind of had to bend over backwards explaining that this doesn't exactly go in our culture, you know, and this isn't really expected of you, and so forth. And the Indian people who see this, you know, nice talk, but where's the action? More Christian than you are. This whole idea of saving for a rainy day, you know, our whole philosophy, you save for a rainy day, and you look for tomorrow, what tomorrow holds, and you don't do anything rash today, or even you sacrifice today for tomorrow, you know? We've got thousands of people in our country who are paying premiums on insurance and social security and all this thing, you know, and they're denying themselves and denying their children and so forth. And this is foreign, nonsensical as far as these Indians, and they live for today. And then let tomorrow take care of itself, you know, as a familiar thing. And if they want, instead of working today, they want to be with their family and take a trip to Omaha and enjoy the family picnic or the Indian powwow down there and meet all the relatives, the heck would work. See, it's more important. It's higher on the ledger of value to be with family and people to whom you belong and to enjoy one another than it is to sit and smell pickles from 8 in the morning until 6 at night because the rainy day might come and you're going to need that money, you know. Heck wouldn't go so. You don't want to live that way. So you've got all of these conflicts and cultures. And then there's a uniqueness, I think, also with respect to the necessity for us to kind of shuck and get rid of some of the accepted pattern and formula approaches to ministry and mission, and to discover meaningful and workable ways to relate to and communicate with Indian people. The Indian people have been programmed to death, and studied to death, and experimented on to death. And we've never really given any thought to what kind of approaches, what kind of structure for church and community and ministry are going to work among Indian people. And it's a but in this uniqueness, almost demands, I think that almost demands a kind of a fast on words and a speech on words. And a fast on words and a speech on presence. We've been in there with the words. The churches have worked with Indian people, not so much the Indian churches, but other churches have worked with Indian people for hundreds of years. And in since the Indians have been resident and not moving and roaming around, single established churches like the Roman Catholic, Episcopal, Presbyterian, have been in one place with one group of Indians for over 100 years. And they've been really verbalized all this time. But they're throwing up their hands today and saying, we've been talking for 100 years and the Indians haven't heard it. They haven't heard a thing of these guys. And if they've got their churches full of nominal Roman Catholic and Episcopal Presbyterian Indians, they're kind of perfect Christianity. We got to give the Indians an opportunity, I think, to release pent-up pressures. And this is not a difficult thing. You know, the Indians normally don't want to hurt anyone. They're charitable people. And so if you tell them Jesus Christ died for your sins, yeah, Jesus Christ died for your sins. You believe that? You think a great deal of that? And I wouldn't want to contest that one bit, you know. Is that right? Okay. You invite an Indian in, you know, and he doesn't tell you what he thinks, he tells you what he thinks you want him to say. And he knows he studied you well enough so that he's got a pretty good idea of what you want to hear. And he comes up with some beautiful things, and man, it's great. This is what we want to hear. But then, when he gets some grit under his belt, and he has an opportunity to release some pent-up pressures, and he finds a priest, I was just talking yesterday with a Roman Catholic priest who spent his whole life in ministry to the Indian East. And he actually just got his guy's belt. So I come up to his apartment and told him, I don't have beer. Whiskey, because this is the only way these kids level with. And he begins to hear some of the things that are really on the mind of these guys. And he starts cussing out this particular sister and this particular priest, you know. And they just dirty sons of bees, you know, and all of this. And then the next day, Christ, you know, pulls it up a little bit. Hello, sister, hello, father, you know. Everything is just the way you want.
We prayed it really nice. We didn't have much beer.
We've got to somehow begin to know, and we've got to somehow restrain ourselves and our talking and our prescripting, prescribing. And we've got to be quiet and attentive enough to give the Indian people a hearing. And let them blast us. Let them come out with all of this hostility. You know, we've been painted as the boogeyman, as the devil to the Indian people. And they believe it. They actually believe it. And there's a great fear, there's a great with respect to white people. And because we're real, you know, now our kids hear about boogeymen, but they're long before they realize that there is no such thing as a boogeyman. They've never seen one, you know. But these grandmothers and grandfathers teach their Indian children about the white boogeyman, you know. Here comes one riding down the street in a pickup truck, you know. He's real. And here's one in the post office. And here's one in the bar, and here's one in his land, you know. And these things take on real meaning for them. special needs. The whole panorama of social, economic, health, education, psychological needs to which I've alluded in some of the introductory remarks to history. So complex of needs is special. In view of that the Indian Indian-ness of this whole complex. We can't compartmentalize our treatment and our ministry to Indian people. It isn't enough to get a guy a job. Someone bailing and occupying and say, all I need is a job and get them back on the street and so forth. So you can get a lot of these Indian jobs, but that doesn't help one bit because they need so many other supports besides the whole complex of things. Become disabled in the paternalism that has been suggested, the dependency status, and the poverty culture that has been inflicted upon them. They're totally disabled in so many ways. That one little ministry there, in one area of their life, doesn't help a darn bit. For example, a job. To get a kind of job and use biology is just as great, Since it really can expect them to come out of the town and to shape up and be a responsible person. And then what happens? His relatives move in on him, his cousins and his aunts and his uncles, and they expect, and he feels obligated to support them. You see, the extended family. He's supposed to take care of that for that $85. And not just his own immediate family. We don't understand this, so we're critical. This guy can't hang on to a job. He takes his wine and blows it. And it's just worthless and no good. But man, he had your relatives all moving in with you. And not for a couple of days, but for weeks and months and as long as you're earning. As long as you're able to provide, you probably blow your wine too. And you probably figure it's better for me not to have a job. And a lot of you don't even have to figure it this way. I think there's a special need that we try to relate to also, and that's trying to jack up our churches and our people. There's a structure that constitute our church and the people that constitute our church, and jack them up with respect to the real discouraging call of hopelessness and indifference that has blighted Indian concern and defeated attempts at Indian ministry in our church. District or someone tries to send a vicar up to an Indian area for a year or 2 years, And the guy doesn't come back to the Sunday school full of Indian children, and they are hopeless. These people are no good there. Why waste our money on them? Let's turn to more productive fields of service. And this happened in a number of instances. And individual congregations, too, because they haven't understood the whole milieu of the Indian world. They expect because of EDS that Indian children had a lot of kids involved one summer, but then their follow-up efforts come to naught, there's no sense. No sense in even trying to relate to these people, much less to mean that the gospel to them. And so they give up. So it's a very special need in Indian ministry to help educate our people, to this kind of understanding of things I'm mentioning. There's a special need to unite and unify and make the most of the limited and isolated established Indian ministry operations already extant under Eastern offices in America. We don't have much, but we've got something. We've got a few contacts with Indian people that we don't enjoy for the most part in our church. And rather than just ignore isolated Indian ministry operations and provide them no encouragement, no support, and kind of maintain them in status quo or established operations. We need to encourage and support them and equip them to launch out and to share with the rest of the church the benefit they have learned in that along associations with Indian people. For instance, we've got it's interesting too that all of our established older Indian ministry operations within the Lutheran churches, and I mean older by those that date back to 4, 5, or 6 years ago, all of these have been inherited from other denominations that gave up the ghost. The three Missouri Synod Lutheran congregations of Indian people in the north of Wisconsin. We got these back in 1898 from the Presbyterians, because you see, the government under Brand had established a peace policy wherein Indian missions of all the denominations were subsidized almost 100% by the federal government, because the church was the government's agent of civilizing the Indians and establishing them. And so the mission treasury was filled by the U.S. federal government. Okay? And even such churches, there's the Baptist Church, you know, who goes into the mixture of church and state and so forth. Well, you just go back 100 years and their church missionary efforts were totally supported by the federal government. And then when the government started pulling out of this, it wasn't working quite so well. Then these missionaries and mission endeavors of some of their churches were left high and dry. And no more government funds, so they had to close up shop. And then the Indian people looked around for more big white fathers, you know. And so they came to the Lutherans up in Wisconsin, and we inherited a big operation up there, which since we inherited, it continued to kind of go downhill. And it just kind of maintained the status quo operation. But there's some real potential and some real rejoice in these few isolated Indian ministry operations that we have extant, that will only use them and the service of the church. There's a real need too to inject Indian blood and Indian presence into our Indian ministry program and check some of our paternalistic precautions. And most of the churches working among Indians don't have Indian leadership. They've simply imported a rural American white churches into the reservation. And then we provided our own priests and church workers to kind of shepherd and maintain the operation without ever really structuring in any live and meaningful way or building Indian people into the leadership and the governance of Indian Christian, Indian Lutheran churches. The future of such a ministry, I think it's kind of statistically bleak, and we're going to be concerned about the number of Indian scalps or souls we'd like to hang from the Lutheran gun belt. Really bleak. It's going to be financially expensive if we're going to put up the capital price on conversion. It's going to be probably a lot less promising in return of those who glorify God than the percentage. And then Christ experienced it with 10 lepers. That's Christ didn't stop having to do with lepers, you know. Just because he didn't get a good return in his investment. The future of this ministry, I think, however, is going to be pretty exciting. If there's anything to this stuff about servanthood and sacrifice and unselfishness and grace without any strain, you know. And probably more
hopeful than ever if by Jesus is going to some of the current signs coming out. I don't have time to go into some of the current signs, but maybe you can ask about them in the question. But there are some encouraging things. I just mentioned the fact that now after a lot of griping on the part of people and persons in our church who have been involved either professionally or as lay people with Indian concern, with Indian ministry for many, many years, you know, and without any real recognition from the powers that be in the church in terms of support and help and encouragement. And finally, some of the national bodies are beginning to think twice about their responsibilities in this area. We just came back from a meeting in New York with the Lutheran Council, and the Lutheran Council and the representatives from each of the jurisdictional Lutheran bodies connected there too, again in 1969, to be considering a proposal that I made to Lakuta as kind of a springboard to introducing discussion. A proposal for an Indian Ministries Resource and Service System. I couldn't think of any shorter name for it. But the idea would be to, for the first time in the history of the Lutheran Church, to kind of identify our Indian Ministry efforts, coalesce them to the extent that it's possible, and make them a cohesive force for carrying on Indian ministry. Unite as has never been united before our concerns with Christian ministry in this system. In other words, we would have the mission department and the social welfare department working together without any kind of a departmental division here. This would be a total ministry. We would draw possibly upon the educational expertise of one of our colleges, maybe like Arizona College in Sioux Falls, it's another Eastern college, where we would have that feed in. And then we would kind of relate regionally and in ever widening circles to the whole of African Indian Synod, the kind of a Lutheran Indian ministry center, regional center. And if it's possible for these problems that are so overwhelming for one little missionary out in Timbuktu and all of our kind of resource and support. I've got a few other things about some of the questions you've asked and how we relate to the church's whole ministry and so forth. I'm not going to spend a great deal of time on these though, but I think this is one ministry in which pastors and missionaries and emissaries can't do the job. They can't do it. If we don't have the priesthood of all believers operative on every level, you know, all these sociological, psychological, health, education, welfare, all these levels. We can't do it. We can't do a thing. The church has been sending missionaries to the Indians for too many years now and accomplishing to do nothing, practically. And pastors and professional church people, you can't handle it. You're kind of the symbols of white supremacy and broken promises. Almost as bad as the real ministers.
Included in the past, especially at the time of the West, when the Indian reservations were being established, but often Indian agents were clergymen.
Absolutely.
And not always the best clergymen to take advantage of the Indians. Mm-hmm. They were just coming to see this, but didn't know what they were doing.
Right. And these things the Indian people remember. And even if they do have, there are lots of tremendous good white pastors, great pastors among the Indian people who dig with them, you know, are concerned and help them in very simple ways and so forth. The Indian people like them. But hate the whites, you know.
somehow or other, the blind person cannot communicate the concern of the church, you know? The concern of all of the people who can pay the church. And it's hard in a short presentation like this to communicate that we're talking here not only of these Indian people, you know, that live in remote areas of South Dakota and reservations where white people don't often get into. But we're talking about Indian communities and Indian areas, reservation areas that make up 25 or 30% of a small community of 5,000, I'd say, South Dakota and some other states, where Indians and whites have what seems to be a certain degree of integration. I mean, they shop in the same markets, they go to the same schools and so forth, you know. But there's no communication. There's absolutely a big block wall between these two people, or these two societies, these two communities. And as long as that wall continues to remain, it's just going to be the ministry is going to be a whole different. But we're not communicating with people. Well, we have a priesthood of believers. We just ran out in one of the towns in South Dakota. We had a staff working, working American mission. This year, a recent Christian, a very big staff. He was in the Stavanger ministry, trying to get some interaction between Indians and whites in a little town in South Dakota, trying to get some real communication. And he just ran out of town. People were burning, the whites were burning crosses in his backyard and everything else. You don't read much about the prejudice and the discrimination in Indian areas, because Indians don't usually make a storm about it. They begin to get one another. They haven't in the past. Well, I'm going to stop here because it's getting pretty close to the closing time. I'm going to let you ask some questions now. I've got a little more on what some of the skeletal outline provided, and I think that maybe some of those might be questions. Yeah?
This is really a mess. What is their sense of time in their culture? I've never had much Sunday, but I live in Oklahoma, and the presence there was pretty tight. But when you drove out west, California last year, you come across them and be dressed in beautiful clothes, and maybe we call them Holden, maybe out there, you know, he goes. And, they literally, and I crossed it a couple of times, maybe 20, 30 miles from any kind of a resident. And they'd be alone walking, And, when you live in this kind of a world where the rigid time that they're doing, you look at it and you say, dude, what are they doing out there? And what's the purpose of it?
Well, this is just another incident of the conflict that. Now, we're 3 months late to come home. And I have a book on the next day. And he, at the time, practically governed and ruled us. Now, the Indians get the opposite. And all this is tempered to some degree because he's had to kind of live in two worlds. You know, he's got 1 foot in our world and 1 foot in a world that once was, but they disintegrated to such an extent that they only. Remnants of it left. But subconsciously, he still observes a lot of these Indian values in time, or in the food language, if there is even a word for time. Time serves you. Time serves you. You don't serve time. And if you're going to have a meeting or a get together somewhere, we'll see you next Tuesday, might be as close as you can get to it, Or they'll schedule a meeting, or send out an agenda and everything, and begin at 9 a.m., and you go there, and I sit there. About 11 o'clock, a few Indians come in, and about 1 o'clock, we're ready to start,
I have a brother in Africa, a father-in-law in India, and they said the same thing, especially in India, where church service will be scheduled for 9 o'clock, but no one shows until 10:30, 11 o'clock. When everyone's there, inside, everyone goes on and they do like it. Because people don't seem to hold a grudge, you know. They're not ready to really make a concept of, the white culture. It's very well used.
Do you have anybody who does?
What do you, you're an executive, I mean, according to this one sheet here, you are the coordinator for all human nations of the LCMA, is that right?
Yeah.
Ministry, isn't it? Well, actually, I'm a consultant, and how this thing started was, the South Dakota District particularly felt that it wasn't getting anywhere with some of the sporadic approaches and attempts at Indian ministry that had been taking place throughout the years. And they made a deal with the Board for Missions of the Senate to set a task of free, absolutely free, no congregational responsibility, to study the Indian theme in South Dakota in depth, just to listen, just to look, and really do some of these things we have been mentioning here. And in the course of this, why I discovered pretty soon that, man, you can't just do a depth study of South Dakota Indians without becoming involved with the whole national scene, because you see, Indians are different. They relate primarily to the given state in which they live, but it relates more directly to the federal government. They have their own legal system, Certain, all of the major crimes and so forth, felonies and enough, these things are handled not by the state courts, but by the federal courts. Their own legal system. And then, of course, they depend upon the federal government for all the services, not upon the state government. So pretty soon you're enmeshed in a national situation, and the national church body said, well, we'll call this guy a national consultant. And let him relate not only to South Dakota, but also to other districts of our church and other national things going on in Indian affairs, and pretty soon I find myself traveling that way in my life, but this is it. But it's primarily a helping and kind of equipping consultative type of ministry that I provide in terms of individuals, pastors, congregations, districts, organizations of the church that are interested in any way in relating to the Indian scene. Yeah.
You mentioned that Indian people, not just the function of pastor, but all the areas of life, would it be advantageous to have a, say, a person, with theological background who would not get a call, to be ordained or anything, but perfectly be slotted in some kind of a profession with the idea that, the training would be valuable in that profession, but not be specific, to be a missionary.
Yeah. Because I don't think there's any doubt, and we're attempting to do some of this. We're attempting, for example, to make use of some of our parochial school teachers up in some of the government schools in Canada, which they can just teach school there, but kind of relate to the people and learn to know the people and be there as a Christian presence, And even not non-theologically oriented people in our church, but Christians, we've identified a lot of them already within the structures of government and education in Indian areas, And I try to equip them, if they have a ministry to them, kind of a chaplaincy type of ministry to them. Forget about the Indian kids in Sunday school, Indian kids in church, But just try to equip these people better to relate and understand and communicate with Indian people on a non-professional basis, after the age of 5 days. And that's all. But we need you.
Yeah. had the Indians stand up in these cities and divide the community from the, away from the reservation and more so away from the farm. They divided the Indians. How would you see a pasture in an area like that in relation to these people that come in?
Yeah. Well, this is a good question because there are an awful lot of Indian forces, the government has had a relocation program which has poured a lot of Indian people into a lot of metropolitan areas, like Los Angeles and Chicago and Denver and places, Cleveland, places like this. And there are large numbers of Indian people who are bewildered, completely lost, helpless in this kind of situation. A lot of them give up in frustration and return to the reservation, or they end up in a kind of skid row type of an existence in these cities. And how to get with and relate to these people? Now, about the most promising thing that happened is a desire on the part of these Indian people to get together and establish Indian clubs and Indian associations, where they can at least experience some kind of a sense of identification with something other than what they're exposed to day by day. And there are opportunities for pastors, for instance, in the Chicago area, in Los Angeles area, to relate to some of these Indian organizations, you see, and to begin to make some acquaintances, to begin to familiarize themselves with some of the needs and some of the problems that these people are facing, to kind of avail yourself and your people and your church for ways and for things and services and needs that these Indian people themselves uncover. I think this has got to be the approach in some of these large areas. We don't have any other approach, any other opening, because they're scared to death of us. If we come and approach them and pastor and invite them to our church, we may even get them there. They may experience a big wall that they can't cut through.
You may have mentioned that, but I don't recall it, though, on the Indians' religion and religious sense. Is there any continuation of the ancient tribalism there, and the missionaries have overcome, paganism, whatever?
Did
they actually take to a certain denomination?
This is probably one of the biggest unknowns in this whole area. The people that have worked longest among the Indian people and who have come to a self-realization that really most of what we've done has been to no good end, they have discovered that the one thing that the Indian people had not really leveled with us on, and had not really revealed for us to know anything about, is their relationship to God. Yet there seems to be some kind of an ingrown spirituality among these people that we get glimpses of on the occasions when they get together, that is pretty forceful in their lives, but we don't know a great deal about it. And most of the things about Indian religion that we talk about and that we write about and so forth are things that we've read about in work written by white anthropologists, and white students of Indian culture and this type of thing. Most of these guys who really ought to know about Indian people say you can't trust this stuff because it's fabricated. And so we really haven't gotten from the Indian people. You see, we've taken everything away from them and destroyed everything that ever stood for. And this last vestige of spirituality and this association and relationship with God and nature, which is so strong in their lives, and with many players responsible for their survival, they really haven't told us a great deal about it. And this priest says he has come, I mean, he's had to check all of his pre-practical seminar and so forth. He taught a religion class and said the only way that he could even get any kind of communication and response from his kids was by checking his whole religious vocabulary. And he told us that. He said, if I ever mention God, if I ever mention the church, if I ever mention grace, you know, things like this, you raise your hand and I'll shut my mouth, you know. But this guy has come and he's got to take a kind of a psychological approach, cultural approach to these people before they even listen to him. Otherwise, he says he'd be talking and having his lectures and they'd all be sitting there, you know. And he said, so here. And yet, now he's been participating in some very deeply religious ceremonies that the Indian people have. And they still, most of the Indian people are kind of syncretistic, you know. They have accepted certain Christian terminology and they're incorporated in the totality of life. Yet, when it comes to a burial and a funeral, some of these important things in their life, they'll go back and they'll have an old Indian ceremony. Many times, none of the Indians will confess to be able to tell you what it means, but it's necessary for them to have it.
I think all of us have grown up with the idea of the cliche. You tell me if it's a cliche or not, but the low tolerance Indians have for alcohol, is that right?
No, that's
more so than white men.
I think that's largely thought to be a myth. Alcohol has become a very convenient and satisfying state for a lot of people. And it's only through the use of alcohol that they become something other than they are. And they're not very satisfied with what they are, and they want very much to become something else. And alcohol is the only real ready source of entertainment and music. You know? They don't have the opportunity to...
Were there some laws and books in some states and communities that couldn't sell it to an Indian?
These still exist in many areas of the country. Now, most reservations can't sell alcohol, and so this is the pity of it, too, that the white establishment gains and profits from Indian alcohol, because the Indians go off the reservation to buy their alcohol and drink their alcohol. And because you can't even have alcohol in his possession on some South Dakota reservations and others. And so they buy it from the whites. And it's true that there's a tremendous percentage of Indian alcoholism and so forth, but there's also a tremendous percentage of Indian suicide. When alcoholism no longer provides the escape, the Indian suicide rate is 10 times as high as and the white suicide rate. So this is what Robert Kennedy was all excited about. And suicide was something that in the old, the traditional Indian culture was never. I mean, this was, an Indian never committed suicide. But you see, there. So
how do we minister, we Lutherans, minister to Indians through a very structure, coming out of reservation, and building the church and,
Well, this is what we're trying to get away from.
This is the kind of historic ministries that we've kind of inherited and perpetuated and maintained over the years. But within the past 4, 5, 6 years, the attempt has been to steer away from this type of cross and candlestick type of ministry and to deploy our forces in a non-traditional, non-conventional church setting.